It seems a fertile area for thriller writers, the world of cryptocurrency. It's so volatile and there's so much chicanery that comes with it. But the book we're about to discuss is possibly, says its author, the only cryptocurrency thriller in the world. Dr. Rosie Fenwick has moved away from medicine. She's a full-time mystery writer these days, living in Martinborough. And Rosie's already written the Euphemia Sage Chronicles, a trilogy of books, Death, Actually Hot Flush, and No Sweat. She also edited, in practice, the lives of New Zealand women doctors in the 21st century. Her new book is Cold Wallet. Kia ora.
Kia ora, Jim.
There'll be people listening who haven't caught up with your new life yet who think, hang on, Rosie was my GP.
Yes, there will, but I've now been a full-time writer for about a year and thoroughly enjoying it.
You're from Gore. You went to school in Invercargill, then Otago Uni to do medicine, and that's enough of the CV, really, because you're a writer now. Why Martinborough as a place to live?
Because the climate is fantastic and the village is wonderful. The people here are old New Zealand. They're a complete cross-section of New Zealand society. Everybody is incredibly kind. It's just the most wonderful community. That's why I love living here.
What else do you do besides write in Martinborough?
I walk my dogs every day. And one of them has just had an operation on the knee, so I have to put that one in a backpack. I garden. I try and do as much exercise as I can. I read a lot of books. It's a very, very nice life.
Always seems a nice life, the writer's life from the outside, but it's got its trials and tribulations, of course. But let's talk about Cold Wallet. In Cold Wallet, we have the young and gorgeous Jess, a hospital doctor who's swept off her feet by the charismatic, rich and highly intelligent Andrew, a cryptocurrency entrepreneur running an exchange called Voltange. Is that how you say it? Not voltage, but Voltange?
I was thinking more Voltange because it's a mixture of vault, as in a repository, and ange, as in change.
Ah, right. That's how that name came into your head.
Yes.
Now, summarising without giving the plot away, and in the case of this book, that's not easy. Good characters, bad characters, you're never sure who's genuine and who isn't. It's as slippery and ambiguous, Rosie, as the cryptocurrency world itself. And there is a gigantic clue, really, early on in your book to unlock the mystery of the missing millions, which I'm sure we all miss, but I thought I'd throw that in because people will be thinking, oh, what is that clue when they read your book? But it's quite hard to pick at the start, I think.
Yes, yes. I'm glad you picked that up. That's very clever that you did.
No, I only picked it up at the end.
Okay, well, that's the best place to pick it up then.
That's right. So more twists and turns than my garden hose. Andrew has a medical condition. He dies early on. I'm not giving that away because the publisher's already told us that in the blurb. On their honeymoon at a fabulous resort in Fiji. And the problem is that there are millions of dollars in a cold wallet that no one can unlock. There are properties owned around the world. Some of the exchange's customers are very dark characters. Jess has been left everything and has to sort it all out. And she has a terrible secret, which soon enough makes global headlines. Now, that's as much as I'm going to give away. How did you get so conversant with cryptocurrency?
A lot of research. And that's one of the most fascinating things about being a writer now is that I have the time to do curiosity research. So I can dive down a rabbit hole and explore every part of something in a way that I couldn't before when I was working. And keeping up to date, because the whole area of cryptocurrency changes so quickly. And I think it's one of the greatest advances of humankind, actually, having done all the research.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that. What is a cold wallet?
A cold wallet is a repository for a Bitcoin, well, not necessarily Bitcoin, a cryptocurrency key, which is a line of numbers and letters, which is the cold wallet itself is offline. And so it's a way to store your money or your cryptocurrency without anybody being able to get to it.
and a hot wallet is online.
That's right.
One thing you don't want to do with either wallet is forget your password ever.
Exactly, exactly. I had a nightmare once. I'd made my password so hard to understand that I had forgotten how to understand them, and I had to redo all my thinking.
I know you read about these horror stories of cryptocurrency. Do you have any of your own money in Bitcoin or Ethereum or any of the others?
A tiny little bit, which grew to quite a big bit last year, so I'm quite pleased.
Okay, but then can shrink to quite a small bit, can't it? That's the thing.
Well, yeah, historically it keeps going up. It's a bit like house prices, like any rare asset or store of value. So historically, it's certainly volatile. It goes up and down more than the share market, but it is steadily rising, depending on the cryptocurrency that you buy, because there have been 80,000 cryptocurrencies developed since 2008. Most of them have gone broke, and so you need to do a lot of research and know what you're doing before you buy any.
Despite all that checkered history, do you think, Rosie, that these are the currencies of the future? And if so, will they be taken out of the hands of the early adopters and the libertarian entrepreneurs and whoever else trades in them and become fiat and controlled by governments like the rest of our currencies? You must have thought about this.
Yes, I don't think that's possible. I think fiat is fiat and cryptocurrency is cryptocurrency because no one owns it. The network owns it, and the network is a decentralized ledger. In other words, it's spread all over the world, and it's a record of transactions which is held by millions of people now all over the world. And while there are certainly people like Elon Musk who are whales who own 10,000 or more bitcoins, there are now more people on the network who own less than one bitcoin and more people who own less than 10 bitcoin on the network. And the network becomes more powerful the more users there are. That follows something called Metcalfe's law, which applies to all networks. The introduction this month, of it as legal tender in El Salvador.
In El Salvador, yes. And that's why I asked the question, because what confuses me is that you can see the attempts by governments, El Salvador and China and various people, to put their fingers in the pie and to get in on the action, you see.
Well, they're not so much getting in on the action because they can't. What they're doing is they're facilitating the repatriation of remittances to their country. One of the problems with traditional banking is that 30% of the world's population, or 2.1 billion people, have no access to those banks. Now, when you're earning a low wage and repatriating $400 million to El Salvador from the US every year, until now, those traditional banks have been clipping the ticket and taking away $50 million in transaction fees. With the Bitcoin network that has been set up by the government in El Salvador and something called the Strike, with a K, not the Stripe network, using the Lightning chain, it's now possible to repatriate the total $400 million to the country. So you can imagine what a boost to income that is to a third world country that normally, you know, just doesn't have access to banking networks.
I understand. But while we're doing Crypto 101, boosts to the economy usually come in the form of taxation. And isn't this the ongoing issue, or one of them, with crypto as well?
I think that's the whole point, because taxation requires a nation state. And what we have with cryptocurrencies in all their forms, it rises above nation states. And so what we're going to have to look at to fund the real verse as opposed to the metaverse, where increasingly money is being generated, we're going to have to look at different forms of taxation. And I have now come to the conclusion that we're going to need a consumption tax rather than an income tax, because that's going to be the only way that a country is going to be able to fund things like the health system or education systems.
That's interesting, because this is the sort of thing that most of us think about when we try and get our heads around crypto. All right. Piha, Mission Bay, Bucklands Beach, Point Chevalier, a trendy suburb to the west of the city, from where I'm talking to you right now.
Very trendy.
I hadn't noticed that quite so much. A few places in Auckland get a mention. The island of Corfu in the denouement of your book. Do you travel for your writing? Do you have to travel much out of Martinborough for your writing?
Oh, absolutely. It's essential. No, luckily I have been in the position to be able to travel quite a lot throughout my life. My mother was a great traveller and she made me, well, she didn't make me, but she encouraged us to travel to see the world. And Corfu was a place that I always wanted to go because of Gerald Durrell and my family and other animals. And the beach that I describe is real. The restaurant that I describe is real. It's just around the corner from the White House where Gerald Durrell and Lawrence Durrell lived and where Lawrence Durrell wrote the Alexandra Quartet. So it was just something that came into the book of its own accord.
Yeah, that's
but
quite
I would
nice.
Like to travel more. I need to go to Scotland to research some areas where my family came from to write another book that I've got in mind.
Go in summer.
Well, unfortunately, I think I'm going to have to go in winter. I did live there for a year. I lived in Edinburgh for a year working at the Simpson Maternity Pavilion, delivering babies, 72 hours, shifts. And so I know what winter is like there. I've lived in a cold tenement building wrapped up in fur hats and scarf. Yes, it was very cold.
And recently, in the name of research, you fell into an ice-cold lagoon.
Yes, I did. You have done your research. That's coming up in my next book. And I was all alone at Punui Lagoon and put my foot down on what I thought was solid ground and went straight in. And the only people there were my dogs, who sort of looked at me as though I was completely nuts, and I had to get back into my car with my gumboots full of water, dripping water everywhere, and drive all the way back to Martinborough. And it's a 45-minute drive, so the car was completely steamed up by the time I got home.
Before we get back to cryptocurrencies, university education, I notice, gets a side swipe in your book, considering you've had one. Not all university education, but at one point you say, it's downright foolish to go into debt to get a piece of paper which is outdated the moment it's printed.
In exchange for the amount of debt that someone goes into, with no guarantee of getting a job at the end of it, I have to wonder as to whether our universities are gearing our young people for the world that awaits them. And the world that awaits them is very different from the world when I went to university in the 1970s, in that we have moved from an industrial age to an information age. And it's highly important that people are able to negotiate their way through the morass of information, good and bad, to be able to determine their own destinies. It worries me that we produce a lot of people with degrees aimed at following a passion rather than aimed at putting food in your mouth.
Okay.
I think that the two are compatible, but I think that one is higher up in the needs than the other.
Getting back to cyber, Cold Wallet is the book. Andrew, the one who dies at the start, leaving Jess in control of a company doing things she knows nothing about. Andrew is a cyber genius. He can pick fluctuations and trends better than anyone. He'll take a position in the market. He'll make money. He'll bail before anyone else picks what's really happening. And he starts off as a Bitcoin miner, but the returns from that are diminishing, so he turns into a minder of other people's Bitcoin. Now, just tell us, what's a miner? I mean, I know Bitcoin will be finite, for example, but people do still mine. You and I could mine if we were prepared to set ourselves up doing it. So that's mining, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's processing the transactions on the blockchain. So the Bitcoin is not the blockchain. The blockchain is the technology which the Bitcoin network uses. There are many other uses for the blockchain which are equally fascinating, and we're only just starting to understand them. When you process the transaction or you win the algorithm which is behind the mining, that behind the transaction processing, then the reward for getting the answer right is what is Bitcoin. It started out at 50 Bitcoin for every transaction processed. And in the beginning, back in 2009, 2010, when the network first started, it was possible to mine using just a simple laptop and the energy required to drive it. And you would be rewarded with 50 Bitcoin. Now, Satoshi Nakamoto, who devised the system, built in increasing complexity so that every 4 years, the algorithms become more complex and the amount of Bitcoin a person who processes transactions is rewarded with, or the amount that they get from mining, that's halved. And it's now down to, I think it's 6.25. But the value of Bitcoin has gone up, which compensates the miner. And there are miners all over the world. They were concentrated in China for a while, but the Chinese government has clamped down, and now a lot of miners have moved to the US and to other, and Turkey is also a big mining area. So yeah, the rigs, the computer hardware that's required to drive mining has become more complex and more expensive, and the amount of energy required has also increased.
Yeah, so there's not as much money in it. I mean, the computer can do the work for you, but there's not as much in it for anybody these days. You'd have to set up quite expensive gear in order to be able to do it for less.
You do, completely right. But at the same time, the price of Bitcoin has increased. So roughly, it's between $45,000 and $55,000 US dollars at the moment. And it started out at zero in 2008. And Bitcoin is now the sixth largest currency in the world.
Yes. Do you think crypto can ever get eco-friendly enough? Because it requires proof of work, which takes up a lot of electricity, and now there's proof of space, which I'm not fully conversant with, and I don't really want to get into it too much because people's eyes will glaze over and other people will know it backwards anyway. But proof of space is friendlier in terms of energy. There's the coin helium, which enables communities of people to mine. Not that I'm an expert, but is it going to get feasible enough, though, in terms of what we're doing and with consumption regarding Bitcoin?
I think it is. As you've mentioned, there are efforts in the cryptocurrency community to address the amount of energy being used. Cryptocurrency transactions use 10% of the energy that the traditional banking network uses. But remember that the traditional banking network doesn't service 30% of the world's population. The other thing too is that you might be aware that Netflix use, if you watch Netflix for 1 hour, then that's enough energy to drive a Tesla Model S for 30 kilometres or to boil a kettle once a day for nearly 3 months. So there are all sorts of ways that we can look at energy use, but who gets to make the moral decision as to which is the correct use of energy? Yeah. That's the underlying argument.
Gee, we're fascinatingly poised. So everything in Andrew's highly successful company is lost to malware. Jess's best friend's dad loses his farm. What reaction have you had so far from the cyber community, from people who've read the book?
The cyber community have endorsed it as a good story.
Good. You know, it really is a digital age, because your children, I was reading, have grown up and left home. One can sew, three of them can cook, but not one of them's ever mowed a lawn, raked leaves in autumn, painted a room, trimmed a hedge, cleaned out the guttering, or dug a border in the garden. And none of them knows how to use a power drill or knows the way around a hardware store. Skills are changing, aren't they?
Well, I blame the parents.
What will become of them, your children, Rosie?
Well, they'll probably do what I do, and that is learn when you need that skill at the time. And I found that, I mean, when I left home, I had mowed a lawn. I had never cleaned out a guttering until my own gutterings overflowed, and then you manage, you needs must. But what I must say is that they are much better on computers than I am. and they are able to pick up technology with an intuition, which I can't. And I have to spend a lot of time working out how to do what they do very quickly. So I think they'll manage.
Same. I thought that generational divide was overstated until I saw how fast our teens can operate and just how much more than me they know. You're an outdoorsy sort of person, just finally, though, because I know that you like to travel to places where wildlife's under threat, and you've been all over the place, very conscious of the environment and how our planet is going.
I am, and it worries me, like it worries everybody in the world, that we're probably past the point of no return. One of the reasons I've travelled and tried to see animals is that I think that tourism helps put dollars onto, put food onto people's plates rather than wildlife onto people's plates. So I was lucky enough to go and see the gorillas in Uganda. That was when I was working in Rwanda at an orphanage for a very short time. I won a competition when I was in the UK to travel and was able to go and see tigers in Nepal, which was fantastic. I've seen orangutans in Borneo and crocodiles in the north of Australia, which probably aren't rare but are very frightening. So I feel very privileged to be able to go into the wilder places of the world.
Yeah, that's great life experience. Well, you've introduced your readers now to cryptocurrency. Well done on the book, and all the best. And thank you for giving us your time today.
Thank you very much, Jim. I really appreciate it.